Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook, and today we're talking about In Stereotype, South Asia in the Global Literary Imaginary by Munalini Chakravorty. The book is published by Columbia University Press, and Munalini is a professor at the Department of English at the University of Virginia. In Stereotype, in my opinion, is a real masterful account which explores the importance of the stereotype in English language South Asian literature. The book works through such tropes as the crowd in Salman Rushdie's Midnight Children or slums in Aravind Adiger's The White Tiger, and many different other stereotypes in many different books. And I think the focus on the stereotype and its enticing and explanatory power really casts fresh light on some of the most important contemporary works in South Asian literature. Moreover, the book is a real pleasurable and challenging read. I had the pleasure of speaking with Munalini just a few moments before. Okay, so without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Munalini to the show. Thanks a lot for your wonderful book, and thanks so much for coming on New Books in South Asian Studies.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Wonderful. So before we talk about your book, I was wondering, could you first please tell us a little bit about your academic background?
Well, I began by studying literature and biology, actually, as an undergraduate. And in my literary studies there, I focused on indigenous literatures, Native American literatures, but I ended up writing a thesis on Salman Rushdie. From there, I went on to graduate school at the University of California at Irvine in what we may call the heyday or the waning heyday of deconstruction and continental theory in general. In graduate school, I became interested in largely philosophical questions to do with the ethics and aesthetics of representation in modernity. So both ethical and aesthetic judgments, of course, you know, have to do with the cultivation of values, conformist normative social values, as well as recalcitrant ones. Particularly in the post-colonial context here, I was focused on the development and dissemination of the colonial, anti-colonial, and post-colonial Anglophone novel. And it seemed to me that the problems that emerged in a post-colonial discourse of hybridity, mimicry, orientalism, of the stereotype, and indeed of a certain, you know, dialectics of the self and other, were the quintessential problems of incommensurable forms of modernity itself, if we may call it that. Such that modernity presented itself through contradictions that had to do with non-Western cultural forms and their articulation within Western colonial political forms and scripts. With regard to post-colonial novels, the period of decolonization and its aftermath became crucial for how these questions, contemplating the relevance of the novel as an adequate vehicle through which to engage the terms of post-colonial societies, were to be negotiated, whether these novels made difference between the global North and South legible, or did they really represent a kind of alignment with certain dominant European ideas of civility, civil society, liberal progress and development, and so forth? So which is why, you know, the book ends up looking at the Anglophone novel as the crux of an important problem of a certain kind of disjuncture, how to convey the oppositional revolutionary energies of an anti-colonial moment, largely after the Second World War, and the more assimilative postures that came afterwards with the post-colonial nations, articulating a kind of conversion to a more global order where a certain kind of normative subjects, you know, the political subject of the state or the economic subject of capital or the cultural subject of the nation, became a kind of site of contestation in terms of representation itself. So, you know, long question. This is a long answer to the question, but this is really how I came to think about these issues in the context of this book.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. I was thinking, as I was reading your book, I always struggle to come up with the first question for these interviews because sometimes it's hard to capture what the book's central idea is in one question. But in this case, you provide the question in the title of your first chapter, which is why the stereotype and why South Asia? So these are my first two questions to you about the book.
Very good. So the book actually begins with a quotation from Gayatri Spivak from her book, Other Asias. And it's just a sort of snippet where she says, I had to think somehow of this phantasmatic Asia, which mediated the stereotype of myself. And of course, her work, along with the work of Homi Bhabha and the stereotype, became very energizing for me, because this quote that I just cited captures a kind of double valence of the stereotype that I wanted to think through, that the stereotype is at once a kind of phantasm, inheres a kind of libidinal investment in an image of authenticity for the subject that has wide cultural circulation and a certain kind of fetish value, and that it is also performs a kind of a mediating function especially in the post-colonial context, in relations between the East and West, between modern and counter-modern, between reality and fantasy, and also between reader and text, ultimately. So I was trying to think about this idea of the stereotype that appears so much more supple and fungible than conventional ideas of stereotypes, cognitive ones, especially even semiotic notions of the stereotype, as iterative but fixed or congealed, you know, ideas or biases about certain groups. And I wanted to probe this doubleness or tension in the context of contemporary South Asian fiction in particular. The second impulse to study the stereotype came from Edward Said's inspiring work and foundational work for thinking about the construction of knowledge between the Occident and the East and the Orient. And of course, Said, you know, identified the stereotype as one of the lenses of disciplinary investment in the Orient for the Occident. And I wanted to investigate this further in the moment that we are in now, not in the earlier centuries, but in the kind of worlding that happens, say, after 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the kind of emergence of a new, we might think, global culture in certain ways. And then the second question, why South Asia? I think partly that has to do with my own training in it. But I also think there is a reason to study South Asian fiction, particularly Anglophone fiction, because I'm not sure the Skype connection. Let me just see. Mm-hmm. Okay. The amazing success that the English novel from India has enjoyed globally. You know, and this is, of course, connected to the question of language itself, specifically of English's dominance in what we might call, after Pascal Casanova, the World Republic of Letters, and the sort of unparalleled global purchase of English. In the first chapter of the book, the introduction, I actually look at Gandhi and how he responded to the sort of pressure of English in India in the anti-colonial moment as the lingua franca of a certain kind of emerging liberal anti-colonial elite. And it was very interesting to me that he thought that English still should be the imperial ambassadorial language of the world for India, even as he was arguing for establishing Hindi as the national language. So I think South Asia is in a unique place. There are so many writers writing the kind of productivity of the novel in English from South Asia has been immense. And so I think the impetus for me to sort of focus on South Asia in this context was relevant. I'm also, of course, interested in the relationship between literary stereotypes and the ideas of collectivism that change in the English novel from South Asia, from its earlier incarnations that were far more individualized, so that you had stereotypes of the lascivious Indian or the licentious Indian or the effeminate Indian that were responsive to, I think, colonial problems of how certain kinds of recalcitrant colonialities should be governed. And these change quite a bit. And I'm more interested in the present book in aggregate stereotypes, not so much in individuals. And in thinking about how those have those individual earlier stereotypes have transformed into or accreted to become collective ones that in fact encompass sort of an entire swath of the region, you know. So the newer stereotypes that the book looks at of overcrowding, slums, terror, genocide, these have more to do with a kind of geopolitics than the formation or negotiation of particular individuated subjects.
Thank you for that. So now let's talk about the individual chapters themselves. The first stereotype that you discuss in depth is that of overpopulation and crowds, as you mentioned these two before. And especially you look at how they're used in Salman Rushdie's novel, Midnight's Children. So I was wondering, what purpose do the unruly hordes and the mobs play in Rushdie's novel?
I think, you know, Midnight's Children, of course, sort of changed the conversation about novels from India. Generically, there were novels, many, many English novels earlier on that focused on a sort of anti-colonial resistance movements. And also, you know, I'm thinking of R.K. Narayan, Mukh Raj Anand, and also of the likes of Anita Desai, who played with form more interestingly in terms of capturing certain kinds of modernist anxieties. But with the genre of magical realism, I do think Rushdie invented something of a kind of newness and presented a kind of collective idea of the Indian subcontinent that hadn't been presented as such before. The other reason I looked at Midnight's Children again after all this time is because the conversation around Rushdie had changed after 1988, and so much has been written about the satanic verses and the fatwa, but I thought Midnight's Children was doing something quite important in terms of negotiating certain anxieties over the future of the post-colony, whether to think of it in a certain kind of as a certain kind of polyphonic experience that was in tension in that novel against the overdetermined emergence of Salim Sinai, you know, the protagonist, highly individuated, educated, liberal, etc. Finally, I wanted to also consider how earlier kinds of stereotypes, Orwellian stereotypes, you might think of the dirty, disorderly mobs in India were being reworked in Midnight's Children toward a kind of new idea of a kind of imminent multitude, you know. And this, I read Hart and Negri alongside the notion or representation of the multitude in Rushdie's book. And what I found, or at least I argue, is that at the heart of this notion of an imminent multitude is the problem of a kind of heteronormative fecund public, and as well as a fecund kind of prose. And I think in Midnight's Children, the multitude is both aligned with a kind of consumptive liberal idea of the state, and this is captured by sort of the last half of the book, where Rushdie narrates or represents the emergency Indira Gandhi's moment, and also a kind of shadow utopia that is more submerged, but nevertheless represented by what we might call fuzzy collectives, of queers, squatters, women, these collectives that are not legible in the kind of future that the post-colony heralds for itself in that book. So in the end, I think what I ended up with was that population stereotypes in Midnight's Children are recast as mobile, resilient, and in some way dictatorial, but at the same time, there is a notion, or at least there is the idea there presented for the reader that there's other things happening in India that don't get recognized in much the same ways. That's why I wanted to look at Midnight's Children in the first chapter. I think it sets the stage for later conversations in the book.
Yes, totally. I agree with that, and I'm glad you did start with that. It's probably the first book about India which I read as a teenager in Northern England years and years ago, and totally confused me at the time, and something to reread. I'm more knowledgeable. And a wonderful book, of course. So my next question is about slums, because slums and slum life have long been present in representations of South Asia, but I suppose recently they've been really put more centrally on the global stage with the success of things like Slumdog Millionaire and Aravind Adiger's The White Tiger. So I was wondering, how does the slums, we say, the dual nature, both as a place of abject poverty and in a place of magical community, how does this dual nature unfold in these two different works?
As you say, the slum has been a kind of old trope within South Asian fiction, and here I'm thinking about Catherine Mayo's Mother India, Kipling's City of Dreadful Night, even something like E.M. Forster's Passage to India. What I am struck by is the sort of re-emergence in global metropolitan theory of slums in articulating particular problems of the North versus the South divide. Of course, Mike Davis's Planet of Slums and Ananya Roy's work on urban India have been very influential in this regard. The chapter actually doesn't consider so much the historical conditions of slum life in India, but looks instead at slums as a kind of very vital metaphor that emerges in texts such as White Tiger, or in films like Slumdog Millionaire. There's a whole lot of other books now, of course, Catherine Boo, a lot of them anthropological in bent. Slums emerge sort of as a metaphorical but dense site of exchange for thinking, or at least interpolating readers to consider their ethical responses to other kinds of stereotypes, that are associated so readily with slum life, those of hunger, overcrowding that I examined in the previous chapter, criminality, and even notions of uneven development or freedom. And what I propose is that these texts, operate by thinking through the informal economies of slum life through what I've called, as you mentioned this in your question, slum magic, where a lot of the characters in these films, in the film or the book, are endowed with fantastic, inventive, or judagu qualities. They are fantastically industrious. They are very good at what might be thought of as ways of shaping cunning life, so that piracy, stealth work, such almost quasi-criminal or illegal forms of life become their mode of existence. And I was interested in the question, what happens when certain kinds of readers or spectators abroad or not affected as much by daily contact with slum life engage these ideas of cunningness? You know, what kind of stereotype does it firm up about the acquisitive nature of South Asian populations, and what kind of a rise does it give to a notion of poverty tourism that is a kind of literary poverty tourism? Not that you sometimes people are motivated to go into slums as a result, but the book or the film itself serving a kind of function or pleasure for the elite consumer in a way that reaffirms their ideas of acquisitiveness and liberal inventiveness, you know, even in people who are so disenfranchised from regular economies. So yeah, that was sort of the motivation for thinking about the dual sort of tracks of slum representation.
Wonderful. Thank you. The next book we'll discuss is a book I've never read, but now I really want to after reading your chapter. And this is Michael Ondaatje's book Anil's Ghost. And this is the fourth chapter now. And I was wondering, my question here is related to, how does death in a post-colonial novel such as this ethically implicate us as readers in the deaths of others who are elsewhere?
Very good. I think you should read this book. It's probably my favorite book of all the ones I've written on. So, you know, Ondaatje, when he was asked about whether he feels a certain kind of different responsibility as a writer living in Canada to portray Sri Lanka in a particular way, he told the story of him reading another story called The King and the Corpse. And that what he narrates there is this sort of North Indian, short story that he came across, where a king, I guess, who has killed someone and buries the corpse, and then every night wakes up with having had this kind of nightmarish dream that haunts him. The dream being that he has the corpse slung around his neck. So I think that's such a provocative story, because it sort of gets to a lot of the concerns of Anil's Ghost, the notion of sovereignty. What do you do when you have power over life and death over others? And also, how does the death of the other affect you? In the context of the novel, of course, Ondaatje, I think, negotiates these questions in terms of a genocide or civil war in Sri Lanka, and really perhaps discovers or reveals a kind of unique poetics that I have called poetics of the subaltern melancholia. So let me just talk a little, back up a little, and say something about sort of this meditation on death and loss in other worlds. You know, Ashil Membe has recently written about necropolitics and the kind of politics of negotiating what he calls death worlds, these spaces of global genocide. And this is a much older conversation. Derrida's Gift of Death tries to think about the sublime experience of individuals experiencing the death of others. And Derrida's conclusion, of course, is a very different one from someone like Hegel's, who thought it was impossible, right, for the for anyone to really experience the death of others. And Derrida makes a much more, I think, almost a psychoanalytic point that, in fact, that is all the death we experience. So for this chapter, I wanted to think through some of these problems and especially because the chapter is about unsettling, you know, a certain kind of the chapter, but also Ondaatje's novel is about unsettling a certain kind of juridical, legal, human rights framework for thinking about violence in South Asia. And Yasmin Siddiqui has a beautiful chapter in her book, Anxieties of Empire, on just this problem of how the detective novel is undone in Ondaatje's work by something else that takes its place. And in the in Anil's Ghost, you get these kinds of multiple focalizations where on the one hand you have the protagonist Anil, a kind of repatriated diasporic subject working for a human rights organization. She's also a forensic scientist who believes in a certain kind of scientificity and instrumental truth, returning to the country to make a case for illegal governmental executions and assassinations. But the novel actually moves away from Anil's focal point quite a bit and gives us a sort of what I might think of as formal play that changes or forces or perhaps makes the problem of death much more complex than it appears in any kind of human rights framework. So, for example, you have Ondaatje, you know, incorporating notions of Zen Buddhism, but also thinking through ideas of piety and of the pieta, a certain kind of affective movement towards others who have borne a loss and why that loss should become an ethical problem for the reader. So the text opens itself in gaps to the reader and leaves certain choices, ethical choices, I think, for the reader to make. That is about interpreting that stereotype of the dead other in one way or the other. So that I think is why that was my favorite book, actually.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Now, South Asian stereotypes, of course, travel. And we have this discussion of Monica Ali's Brick Lane. So I was wondering what happens to the South Asian stereotype when it unfolds in a book like this?
With Brick Lane, I wanted to think about, because so many of South Asian, contemporary South Asian Anglophone novels are also produced and written in the diaspora by diasporic writers who nevertheless still identify quite strongly with South Asia. At least in its cultural terms. I wanted to think about what Brick Lane is doing and the kind of crisis of authenticity it seeks to represent for both migrants and for Britishness, and the ways in which it sort of disrupts ideas of a kind of pristine West unaffected by its colonial history. So the chapter actually considers the controversy over Brick Lane's publication because it was not well received by the community in Brick Lane. And there was this sort of furor over whether Monica Ali, a second generation, half a Bangladeshi woman, could authentically represent Bangladeshis who were first generation in her in England. So I think that chapter really thinks through what after Sarah Saleri we might call the dislocated idiom of migrancy, that reflects both the idea of the West and the way that the West perceives itself to itself, and also a sort of contemplates stereotypes that the West, or at least in the Anglophone context, has of the non-Anglophone social life elsewhere. So, for example, in that book, what is very curious is that Nazneen, the protagonist's sister, Hasina, writes her these letters ostensibly from Bangladesh, ostensibly in Bengali, but whereas neither the protagonist, Nazneen, nor her sister are fluent in English, the letters in the English novel are represented through this kind of very odd, almost jarring broken English. And that sort of, I'm not sure I would have written the chapter in the way, or at least assessed it in the way that I have. But at the moment when I was writing, it sort of indicated to me the intractability of the English novel when it comes to really including with itself within itself linguistic and cultural registers that are really radically other other to the Anglophone context. So the chapter ultimately looks at the stereotype of the migrant, both at the assimilable migrant and the unassimilated, inassimilable the novel Brick Lane, but also within metropolitan British society, to think about, you know, ideas of labor, terror, all the ways in which the West sees itself needing to cut off from the rest of the world, but also, in fact, you know, where these very, very conditions are most often produced by the kinds of contradictions within the metropolitan West now.
Thank you for that. So the last chapter of the book is about transnationalism, specifically those that that come through in Mohsin Hamid's book, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, and also Chetan Bhagat's One Night at the Call Centre. So could you please tell us a little bit about how transnational and how the freedom emerge in these novels?
Yeah, the reason I juxtapose these two is because I really wanted to consider, maybe this is the shortest chapter, so if I had had more time, I would have done a more lengthy study of two different kinds of genres, narrative genres that seem emergent at the moment from South Asia. One we might call novels that engage terror and terrorism in some way as their kind of formative idea of how South Asia is negotiating its relation to the West, and as well perhaps in a lesser way calls the call center genre, or at least novels that are about labor, about work, and this we could also think of as the outsourcing genre. What I think these two novels do are open two different affective registers. You know, the one with Reluctant Fundamentalist is obviously very much about thinking about the figure of rage and revenge, the aftermath of 9/11, the spectacle of the terrorist in our the spectacle of 9/11, but also the sort of insidiousness of a kind of terrorist from South Asia in our midst and so forth. And then Chetan Bhagat's One Night at the Call Center, which is much more pulpy as a book, thinks through the question of hard work and conformity, what happens when you have these kinds of night shifters who are willing to service a certain kind of economy that is already in place. And I think both of these stereotypes ultimately have very important things to say about how freedom itself is being thought as a kind of zero-sum game, where you either have to decide that freedom is a certain form of coercion, whether of labor or an expression of free will. And these are questions that are very central to thinking about the ideas of the liberal subject. And I think both of these novels attempt to, in some way, approach that difference between free will and coercion as the kind of bottom line of how we need to contemplate, you know, freedom as such.
Thank you so much for that. Now, I've shot through this book quite quickly with my questions, as is always the case on this podcast, and we have such rich material. So I was wondering, is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to highlight for those who've not yet had the chance to read the book?
Well, you know, maybe I think the about what I found or what I took away from having sort of studied stereotypes and the ways in which they have been dismissed as sort of stultified, banal, cliched forms, you know, stultifying of language as well, is that actually they're very interesting quilting points, mimetic quilting points, you know, which sort of disclose a kind of instability of mimesis itself that is very generative for thinking about the role of fiction, the relationship that readers cultivate to literature. And in a certain of the cases that I've examined, how stereotypes and their mimetic kind of entry points produce, reveal a sort of failure of mimesis, you know, to produce a responsive kind of a reader in the way that the text at least wants to script it. So I think, you know, I don't have much else to say except that perhaps the big point to take away is that this is a kind of rewriting of Auerbach's notion of mimesis, to think of stereotypes as representing a kind of beleaguered nature of mimesis that moves between a kind of stilted realism and deploys an anxious fantasy that readers bring to fiction often. And also to rethink the genre of the global novel itself as both forwarding a fiction of divided worlds, even as it pretends or often aspires to end these kinds of divisions. Lastly, you know, there's a little concluding section where I touch upon some of the kind of problems of reading that reading stereotypes present. And this is a rich conversation that is happening at the moment in terms of contemporary literature, the kind of disagreements and debates over whether slow reading, distant reading, or a certain notion of world literature or untranslatability in world literature is the most kind of urgent way in which to think about a whole body of works that we are now teaching, that people are consuming, that are being written, where prizes that are winning prizes. So I think maybe if anything that got left out, it's probably this, that people should look at the epilogue, the end section of the book, the epilogue.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. So this book is now out. So this is now pushed away from you. And I was wondering what then are your current and future projects?
Well, I have several different ideas. I'm very interested in several things. I don't know which direction I'm going to go. I'm co-authoring a biography of Freddie Mercury that I'm very excited about, that talks about sort of Mercury as the Thatcherite England and the kind of performance of a glamour rock that was both excessive and entirely conformist during his time. And also of Mercury as a kind of South Asian artist, queer, passing, racially, sexually. So I'm very excited about that book. I think that probably will be done soon, first. But I'm also interested in two other things that I have worked on a little bit. One is a book on hunger in the post-World War II moment and the politics and representational politics of altruism that attach to it in the context of South Asia, but also of Africa. The next one is about the dystopian novel, and I think that's the big dominant emerging genre of English writing now, the dystopian post-apocalyptic novel, and the ways in which it negotiates older questions of magic and magicality and the occult and all of these other things that have been sort of sidelined in the interest of more kind of rational ways of thinking about the world. So those are the projects right now that are preoccupying me.
Wow, wonderful. They all sound fascinating and all very different as well. So I guess you'll be very busy for years to come with these. But wonderful. There's nothing much more for me to do apart from to thank you again for coming on the podcast. I really enjoyed reading your book. I'd like to recommend it to everyone who's listening at home. So thanks a lot for coming on, and thanks again for your wonderful book.
Thank you for having me. This was wonderful.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about In Stereotype by Mrinalini Chakravorty. This really was a great book, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to our conversation. I know certainly I enjoyed talking with Mrinalini, and I hope you download the podcast again next time. Ta-ra.